This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Tobin. We're talking about his 1997 book, Ernie Pyle's War, a biography of the famous World War II newspaper correspondent. When we left off, we were talking about Pyle's depressions. Tobin says covering the war initially helped liberate Pyle from depression, but that sense of liberation didn't last long.
Well, I think that it helped Ernie feel better for a while. And then as he saw more and more of the war itself became the most depressing thing in his life. I think this is, not that I've ever been in the middle of combat or anywhere close to it, but in reading a lot about the experience of war, you find soldiers and reporters saying that after a period of exhilaration and fascination, the more you're exposed to it, the more you become debilitated psychologically and emotionally. And I think that this is what happens to Ernie as the war goes on, as he goes from North Africa to the campaign in Sicily, which was very difficult, the summer of 1943, and then especially to the Italian campaign, which was even worse the following winter, and then to France. He sees more and more death. He himself is exposed to more and more danger, has a couple of very narrow, close calls, almost dies. And nobody can do that and stay stable. You can't stay in combat, modern combat, for a long period of time and be okay. It causes deep suffering in anybody who is exposed to it long enough.
He writes a little bit about the depression and the suffering he was going through covering the war. And he writes about this not in a column, but in a letter to a friend. And the letter I'm thinking of is something that he wrote after losing a friend in the war.
Early in February 1944, a reporter named Raymond Clapper was killed. He was one of these prominent newspaper columnists and had been a colleague of Ernie's in Scripps Howard. Was mostly known as a Washington correspondent, but went to war and was killed in the South Pacific, and Ernie found out about it. And he writes to his close friend and his editor, Lee Miller. He says, "I'm just floored by it. What a waste of intelligence and character. As the whole war is, it gives me the creeps. The whole thing is getting pretty badly under my skin, Lee. I've got so I brood about it, about the whole thing, I mean. And I have a personal reluctance to die that is always in my mind like a weight. Instead of growing stronger and hard as good veterans do, I've become weaker and more frightened. I'm all right when I'm actually at the front, but it's when I pull back and start thinking and visualizing that it almost overwhelms me. I've even got so I don't sleep well, and have half-awake hideous dreams about the war."
Is that the kind of sentiment you think he would have confessed to his readers, or does he save those kinds of the vulnerabilities and the doubts and the overwhelming despair that he's feeling? Does he save that for letters, for personal letters?
He expressed that more often in letters, but he does express it in his column. There are comparable passages in a number of the columns. I think what he does is ration that sort of feeling and that sort of expression. There was a feeling during the war, and I think that this is pretty true in any democratic society fighting a war. There's a line that correspondents feel they have to walk between realism and encouraging a kind of demoralization among their readers. They worry, as Ernie said in a couple of these passages, that people just won't understand it. And I think that this is the reason that many soldiers, after they come home, are reluctant to say what really happened, even to their loved ones. I think a lot of us have found that our fathers and grandfathers who fought in World War II have taken most of their lives to be able to really say what it was like. And it's only near the end when they want to tell people, this was what I went through. When they're younger, it's really difficult to bridge the gap between the front and the home front.
You write how there was a growing difference between the public Ernie Pyle, the people the public knew through his newspaper columns, and the private Ernie Pyle. What was the difference?
Well, it's certainly true that that Ernie had established a kind of persona in the column that was, you know, universally known and loved. And the persona was of a kind of hapless, carefree, kind of Charlie Chaplin-esque figure. Funny, casual, able to kind of bounce from one thing to another without being terribly troubled. And that was very much not what Ernie was experiencing as the war went on. And so there is a kind of divide between the sort of reassuring, comforting persona of the column, who is telling people, you know, it's bad, but your sons, your brothers, your husbands, they're getting through it okay. They'll be all right. They haven't changed deeply. He wants to reassure on that score. And yet, as you said in his letters, you do see a darker side emerging, where he's not so sure about the suffering that he's seeing around. There's one column where he says, I couldn't find the four freedoms among the dead men. That's about the toughest he ever expressed it in an actual column. More often he's saying that sort of thing in letters. And so he does sort of unburden himself to his wife, to his editor, and to close friends.
Ernie Pyle was also known through his portrayal by Burgess Meredith in the movie The Story of G.I. Joe, a World War II film that was made while the war was still going on. And what was the involvement of the military in this movie?
Well, the movie was really the military's idea, and this is an interesting side of the sort of the movie history of World War II that we all know, that I certainly didn't know until I did the research for the book. Early in the war, it was the Navy and the Air Corps that most movies were made about. Those were seen to be the heroic branches of the armed services, and the glamorous ones and the exciting ones. That's where the real action was. Whereas the infantry was, seen as dull and dirty and slogging and not of, not the sort of thing you would make a movie about. So there were figures in the army in Washington who were looking for somebody, looking for a producer who would make a movie about the army, and they came across this young producer, Lester Cowan, whom they convinced to look into this. Cowan actually talked to this fellow, Raymond Clapper, who said, well, if you want to make a movie about the infantry, you should read the columns of Ernie Pyle. And Cowan then went back and read all of Ernie's columns to date and was very much taken by them, and approached Scripps Howard and Ernie and proposed the idea of a movie that would be based on Ernie's work in the field. And so the story of G.I. Joe, which didn't come out ultimately until 1945, is an interesting kind of hybrid. It comes out of this, essentially a propaganda impulse to give the army its due, to give the infantry its due in Hollywood. But then Ernie was so insistent that it be realistic that the army never really got the kind of heroic tale that it wanted, that it envisioned at the beginning anyway. What it got was a kind of a strange movie, an interesting movie, without much of a plot, that is really just more documentary in its feel, and that really does present the new kind of Pyle version of the heroic soldier, dirty, slogging, enduring, not the gallant, rushing over the hilltop kind of soldier.
Some of the film is based on one of Ernie Pyle's most famous columns. Robert Mitchum stars in the film as a very sympathetic captain. And the column that the movie is partially based on is about Captain Henry Wasco. Would you read an excerpt of that column for us and tell us what you think makes this column important?
The column is set in Italy. Ernie was in the mountains with army troops, and particularly with a group that is involved in using mules to bring dead bodies off down from the mountains where the fighting had been going on. It was too difficult and steep for soldiers to bring the bodies down themselves, so they used these mules. So he writes in this column in part, "I was at the foot of the mule trail the night they brought Captain Wasco down. The moon was nearly full at the time, and you could see far up the trail, and even partway across the valley. Soldiers made shadows as they walked. Dead men had been coming down the mountain all evening, lashed onto the backs of mules. The first one came early in the morning. I don't know who that one was. You feel small in the presence of dead men, and ashamed of being alive, and you don't ask silly questions. Then Pyle explains that several more bodies are brought into this clearing by this cowshed where there are men standing. And one of them is identified as this Captain Wasco. The men in the road seemed reluctant to leave. They stood around, and gradually I could sense them moving, one by one, close to Captain Wasco's body. Not so much to look, I think, as to say something in finality to him and to themselves. I stood close by, and I could hear. One soldier came and looked down, and he said out loud, "God damn it." That's all he said, and then he walked away. Then another soldier came and bent over, and he too spoke to his dead captain, not in a whisper, but awfully tenderly, and he said, "I sure am sorry, sir." Then the first man squatted down, and he reached down and took the captain's hand, and he sat there for a full 5 minutes holding the dead hand in his own and looking intently into the dead face, and he never uttered a sound all the time he sat there. Finally, he put the hand down, he reached up and gently straightened the points of the captain's shirt collar, and then he sort of rearranged the tattered edges of his uniform around the wound, and then he got up and walked away down the road in the moonlight all alone.
Why do you think that column had the impact that it did?
I think it had an impact chiefly because it's a fine piece of writing. It's extremely descriptive. It really is just a model of what fine documentary journalism ought to be, in just bringing the reader into a scene and seeing something extraordinary. I think the meaning of the column for people, it affected people different ways. But I think that the chief meaning of the column is that it, between the lines, drives home this poignant theme of the comradeship among soldiers. It's not so much about the captain himself, who is hardly described at all in the rest of the column, but it's about the feeling of the men for each other and for the dead man. And so there's this sense of tragedy and loss, but also of, I think there's a certain reassuring theme between the lines of something good coming out of this awful experience of war, that there's a kind of love that exists in war. And that's one of the themes that we see often in fine war writing, that people will admit to a certain appeal about the experience of war. And that's one of them, is that bond of love among soldiers.
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Tobin. We're talking about his biography of Ernie Pyle, whose dispatches from World War II gave many Americans their most vivid and lasting descriptions of the war. Ernie Pyle died in the war. How did he die?
Ernie was killed in the Pacific. He went home shortly after the liberation of Paris, late summer of 1944, and spent several months in the U.S. Trying to rest, but really being sort of kind of a public figure. It was difficult, and had more difficult times with his wife, who attempted suicide during that period. And I think he came to feel that he couldn't just stop before the war was over. He had to go back to it. And because he had been in Europe so long, although that was certainly the place he identified with, the people he identified with, he felt that he owed it to the Navy and the Marines in the Pacific to go there. And so that was set up with the Navy. He spent time on an aircraft carrier in the Western Pacific, and then took part in the invasion of Okinawa, and then just in April of 1945, went ashore on a little island that is just off Okinawa called Iwo Jima. And really in just a kind of a, not in the middle of a battle, but in just a random situation, he was crossing the island in a jeep. The jeep was fired upon by a Japanese machine gunner, and Ernie and the other guys jumped out and into a ditch at the side of the road. And when the machine gun was quiet, he raised his head up and was hit in the temple and killed immediately.
Was his body found right away?
His body was recovered only after a few hours. There was still the danger of this machine gun nest, and so finally some guys crawled out, and a photographer took a picture of the body, and some other guys pulled Ernie's body back. and the word already was sent out via radio that Ernie had been killed. And it was an extraordinary event. It was only a few days after President Roosevelt had died, and the headlines about Ernie Pyle's death were almost as large as the headlines about Roosevelt's death.
Now, he had a column that he was in the middle of writing that was discovered in one of his pockets when he died. He was expecting that there would be victory in Europe any day, and so he was already writing the column about that victory. The column was never published, but you published some of that in your biography of Pyle. I'd like you to read it for us.
This was just it hadn't been typed up yet. It was in Ernie's pocket, just in a handwritten draft, you know, with crossouts and arrows, and this is part of what he wrote. "And so it is over. The catastrophe on one side of the world has run its course. The day that had so long seemed would never come has come at last." And he said he's writing this in waters near Japan. "But my heart is still in Europe, for the companionship of 2.5 years of death and misery is a spouse that tolerates no divorce. In the joyousness of high spirits, it is easy for us to forget the dead. There are so many of the living who have burned into their brains forever the unnatural sight of cold dead men scattered over the hillsides and in the ditches along the high rows of hedge throughout the world. Dead men by mass production, in one country after another, month after month and year after year. Dead men in winter and dead men in summer. Dead men in such familiar promiscuity that they become monotonous. Dead men in such monstrous infinity that you come almost to hate them. Those are the things that you at home need not even try to understand. To you at home, they are columns of figures, or a near one who went away and just didn't come back. You didn't see him lying so grotesque and pasty beside the gravel road in France. We saw him by the multiple thousands. That's the difference."
Why do you think Scripps Howard decided not to publish this column that he'd been writing?
I think that gets too close to the way people feel when they've been at war for a long time in the middle of it and have a point of view about it that is simply unacceptable to people who have viewed the war from the home front, from afar. That vision of war is just at odds with the way people at home wanted to feel about the war, which was that it was tragic and that, and of course, many had suffered losses, but not that it was this reality that you couldn't, this dark reality that you just couldn't escape from. And that's what Ernie is talking about. Ernie's talking there about what it really felt like to be at war for a long time. And it was ultimately intolerable.
And he's talking about dead men by mass production.
Right. That's a pretty terrifying image.
James Tobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
James Tobin is the author of the 1997 biography, Ernie Pyle's War. His latest book is called To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. Our interview was recorded in April of 2003. Here's a voiceover from the film The Story of G.I. Joe with Burgess Meredith in the role of Ernie Pyle. The words are taken from Pyle's own writings.
"That is our war. And we will carry it with us as we go from one battleground to another until it's all over. We will win. I hope we can rejoice with victory, but humbly. That all together we will try out of the memory of our anguish, to reassemble our broken world into a pattern so firm and so fair that another great war can never again be possible. And for those beneath the wooden crosses, there is nothing we can do except perhaps to pause and murmur, thanks, pal. Thanks."
Burgess Meredith from The Story of G.I. Joe.